judgments all along. And a lot of these, what we see here, seem to be, okay, when this happens, here's the answer. Maybe in some cases based on what had happened earlier. Maybe, for all we know, God is meeting with Moses and saying, remember that time when we had to do this? Put that one in there, and put this one in. So these aren't statutes the way, so much as the Ten Commandments, thou shalt or thou shalt not. A lot of these are, when this situation arises, this is how you deal with it. We could call it case law, sometimes common law, or things like that. And we see that as we move on in verse 22 of chapter 21. If men fight and hurt a woman with child, so she gives birth prematurely. It seems odd that you would just randomly say, well, if this happens. But if that had happened and they had to say, well, what do we do now? Well, then we've got it written down. So they fight, they hurt a woman, which says they're not fighting very efficiently if they hurt the woman who's nearby. It says, yet no harm follows. He'll surely be punished as the woman's husband imposes, and he'll pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, you'll give life for life. Okay, that word harm follows, the old King James says mischief. Yeah, there were in verse 22 where it says she gives birth prematurely. I want to say in the old King James says if mischief happens. The word is akown, the Hebrew. A-C-O-W-N is a way we could transliterate that. So it's translated one place, one translator just said mischief. Another one said, no, the mischief is that she gives birth prematurely. And giving birth prematurely, in some cases the child might live, in some cases it might not. So it's saying, basically you bump into this pregnant woman, she goes into labor early, and it's a difficult thing. Causing a premature birth where the child doesn't die, it seems, could be punishable by a fine. And what the fine is seems to be determined by a combination of the husband of the woman and the judges. So it doesn't give us a dollar amount here. But it goes on to say if the child dies, then it's a capital offense. One thing we've done is that supports the pro-life view if we put it in our modern terminology. There's the debate in society about whether an unborn child is just tissue mass or if it's an individual human being. We as a church have sided on saying it is a human being and that killing it is a tantamount to murder, and that seems to fit with what it says here. And I'm not going to say that's the final all-encompassing word on that subject, but if you're stacking up evidence on either side, this supports one side more than the other. I want to go on, though, because it goes on almost, as a matter of fact, at the end of verse 23, there's a comma, because it goes on from that case to lead into other things, or this general principle. And it says at the end of verse 23, life for life. Then in verse 24, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. That's a lot of, being particular. This is described by a Latin phrase of lex talionis. Has anybody come across that one? Michelle knows it. Okay. What does lex talionis mean? What's that? Oh. I don't think we use that phrase in English. But what I'm getting at is, I'm looking for the way I put it. Yeah. An equal punishment for the crime. Or we'd say the punishment should fit the crime. So how severe a punishment is based on how severe the crime is. You make me lose my eye. Okay, the punishment could be you lose your eye. You cut off, you damage my foot, you lose yours. This can go both ways, meaning the punishment has to be harsh enough to match the crime, but it also says the punishment should not be way harsher than the crime. You don't get the death penalty for knocking someone's tooth out. You might be punished by having your tooth knocked out or paying a fine of whatever value it's meant to be. The punishment should not be too light, it should not be too heavy. And this is the other, I said these two big principles seem to be demonstrated here. One is the punishment fits the crime, and two is you make restitution, which kind of falls within that punishment fitting the crime in one way or another. Is that making sense? And I'm not a legal professor, so I might not be explaining this as well as some would. But, Andrew?
So does the new covenant break this, or do we, obviously we don't eye for eye, tooth for tooth right now. We do it with jail time when it comes to like our law, but what is it? How does this apply to us today?
Well, there are one things I'd say. Again, this is for a civil political government. How do you punish criminals? As a church, we don't punish criminals. So basically our nation establishes laws, and we would presume that God has delegated the nation the authority to do so. A governing principle should be that the punishment should fit the crime. But of course, God also allows within the church for repentance and mercy, and which is an important thing, you know, which I'm very glad of. But, you know, there's ways we'll see other things that we could still put some of these principles, like if I borrow your car and I misuse it and tear it up, I should make restitution. I should make it good. Even though the church doesn't have the authority to enforce that, the state government could. You could sue me. One of the things we'll note, I'll point this out, in ancient Israel, one of the things you don't see commonly is incarceration as a punishment. Doing jail time is not going to be described here. There's paying a penalty, there's corporal punishment, there's capital punishment, you know, being sold into slavery, but there's not spending time in a room doing nothing, which tells me something about the value of that as a punishment. Maybe it's not so good. So, but we're not operating in that physical nation under these type of laws. But we do want to look for the spiritual principle. Okay. And I want to keep in mind that, you know, letting the punishment fit the crime, we don't want to take on ourselves as individuals the idea of punishing someone. So if someone hurts you in a certain way, you shouldn't try to hurt them back in that certain way. What you might be getting at is Christ's principle, you know, he who slaps you on one cheek, turn the other cheek, which doesn't mean you want to go around having people slap you all the time, but we want to be more willing to forgive than people are to repent, if that makes sense. So as a Christian, we want to be even, you know, sort of rise above this and not seeking punishment. We'll defer that to God, but God still wants repentance. And again, I'll refer to Ezekiel 18, where it'll say a person could be doing evil through most of his life, but if they turn and stop doing evil and do good, God will forgive all that past evil. So God's great plan involves forgiveness and not having the punishments that we deserve. And I'm all for that. I don't want the punishments I deserve. I'd rather have the mercy that I don't deserve, but I still like to have. You guys, that fitting in your framework here? Okay, so I want to move on. Verses 26 to 27 involve some more protection for slaves. We introduced at the beginning of the chapter some regulations about slavery. Here it says, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, so you damage their eye and they can't see, he shall go free for the sake of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he'll let him go free for the sake of the tooth. So it goes to show an owner who loses his temper and lashes out could, for that one rash moment, lose years of valuable service. You know, I could get Andrew's my servant. I get mad and I punch him and knock out his tooth. He might owe me 4 more years of service, but sorry, Frank, you lost out. Should have controlled your temper. So beating and misusing slaves is not allowed. Okay, we could see that, and God's going to say slavery exists, but look, you got to treat people like people. Let's move on. And 28, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox will surely be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten. The owner of the ox shall be acquitted. By the way, the Hebrew there for ox is shaur. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Oh, well, that's ox. S-H-O-W-R, I believe, is a transliteration. The reason I'm mentioning that is the Hebrew implies that it's a bull, a male. And, you know, uncastrated bulls can be mean. So the idea of this large animal killing somebody is not unheard of. And the idea is a dangerous animal has to be restrained. And if it can't be, then it should be killed. You know, so the idea is if the ox just randomly, the first time ever it does this, it kills someone, the owner is not going to be put to death for what this animal did. But it goes on for there. In verse 29, but if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past, and it's made known to his owner, and he hasn't kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox will be stoned, and its owner shall also be put to death. So, you know, if a person knows this is a dangerous animal that's liable to kill someone, and he doesn't take steps to protect the people, then he's going to pay the penalty with his own life. Although, it's worth noting there's an exception here. In verse 30, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, he shall pay to redeem his life, whatever is imposed on him. This seems to be the only case in ancient Israel's law where a monetary payment could be made in place of capital punishment. So, and it seems to be at the discretion of the judges if that could be applied, and if so, how much was the payment? So, you know, there's room for looking to say, okay, what's the case? How well did this guy know his animal? What did he do or didn't he do? And that sort of thing. But in most cases, like, you know, if a person just goes out and kills someone, capital punishment. But if the person's ox goes out and kills someone, there's room to say that it might not be capital punishment. Okay, let's go on to verse 31. Yeah, whether it's gored a son or a daughter, it'll be done to him. Verse 32 is where I wanted to get to. If the ox gores a male or a female servant, he'll give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox will be stoned. Okay, 30 shekels of silver here is given as the price for replacing a killed slave. Why would I stop and emphasize that? The price of a dead slave then is 30 shekels of silver. Julia?
That's what Judas received, I believe, when he betrayed Jesus.
Okay, when Judas betrayed Christ, he received 30 shekels of silver. That was Matthew 26:13 is a reference for that. Matthew 26:13, and I want to give you an intervening reference that seems to be a prophecy of that coming up, and that's in Zechariah 11, verse 12. Zechariah 11, 12 is a prophecy that seems to be looking ahead to Judas's betrayal, and it indicates the Messiah being valued at 30 shekels of silver. And if we connect it back here to Exodus 21, we see that that is an insulting amount. What's my service worth to you? Only that of a dead slave, you know, as opposed to a much higher price. And when we go through the minor prophets, I'll point that out when we come to it, but I wanted to make the connection here, because here, Exodus 21, verse 32 is connected to Zechariah 11, 12, which is connected to Matthew 26:13. And the other gospel accounts, which I don't have their scriptural reference written down. But I'm not implying here, doesn't seem that it's meant to be a messianic prophecy. It's a principle that fits that later will be built on to demonstrate something. Okay, so verse 33, if a man opens a pit or a man digs a pit and doesn't cover it, an ox or a donkey falls in it, the owner will make it good. You know, if one man's ox hurts another so it dies, they'll sell the live ox and divide the money from it. The dead ox also they'll divide. So we go through here, a lot of this is, you know, again, the principle of restitution. You know, you do something foolish, like you leave an open hole without putting a barrier around it. Someone gets hurt, you got to make it good. You know, we exercise that today in a lot of ways. You've seen those yellow signs that you put out when you're mopping the floor, and it shows someone falling, and which reminds me when I was in college, I had a friend who looked at the picture. He said, it looks like it's referencing breakdancing, which I don't know if people do breakdancing anymore, but you know, it's meant to warn people, don't slip and fall. Or, you know, in a construction site, they put that plastic orange fencing around. So it's kind of like this, do that or else you're responsible for what could happen. And if for some reason, you know, harm does come, you make it good. My animal kills your animal. Okay, we'll sell the live animal and divide the money, and we'll butcher the dead animal and share the meat. But, you know, we don't just forget it and let it go by. Although, in verse 36, again, another particular judgment. If there was an ox that was known to thrust and its owner didn't keep it confined, he'll pay ox for ox. So, my ox is known to attack others, and it attacks yours and kills it. Well, I get the dead one, and you get the live one. And you can do with the live one what you want, but you got to be careful. It might kill someone else's. Okay. And I'm going to move on. I've got a general note about most of chapter 22 deals with what we'd call the law of restitution. You know, make up for the harm that you have done. Again, I'll say I think that's much more effective than incarceration. You know, if I break the windshield of your car and I can't pay, having me sit in a jail cell for 30 days isn't going to help your car. But if I go out and have to work for the money to pay for it, that helps. So let's look at chapter 22, verse 1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he'll restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. So killing or selling stolen animals, you know, I've read one account said this could even represent a professional crime. So there's a ratio. You know, so it's punished by a ratio of 4 or 5 times what you stole. So there's a built-in deterrent there, supposedly, rather than just if you take the animal for yourself. And I'm not sure, I think the Hebrew implies a difference there that we don't see in English. But the idea is, again, restitution plus punishment in this case. Verses 2 and 3 have an interesting description here. If a thief is found breaking in where? Well, generally it means into a person's house. Thief is found breaking in your house and he's struck so that he dies, there'll be no guilt for his bloodshed. So if I hear someone breaking in my window and I pull out the baseball bat that my wife keeps under her bed, it's funny, nobody laughs, but actually she keeps a club like this under her bed, which when I married her, it's like, what are you planning on doing with that? But she started that when she was single. So I hear someone coming in the window and I, bam, you know, because I don't want him to come in hurt. If he dies, I'm not guilty. Okay, now, but that's not the end of it. It says, verse 3, if the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt. So it's daylight, it's the middle of the day and someone's breaking in, I'm not allowed to hit him and kill him. Now the sun has risen, there should be guilt for his bloodshed, he'll make full restitution. If he has nothing left, he'll be sold for his theft. So this seems to be showing that killing an intruder in the dark of night was not considered murder. Now why might that be? It doesn't tell us, so we're left to guess. So, Andrew, you can make a guess.
One of two reasons, I think. One is that if they're coming in your house at night, you really have no idea of their intentions. It could be to murder or something like that. Also, you might not be able to identify them. So if they, you know, they take your stuff, make a break for it, you can't identify them. And you don't know who they were, possibly.
Okay. I don't disagree there, and especially one particular part of that. That if someone's breaking in at night, are the occupants more likely to be at home? Okay, and should someone know that? So the idea is someone breaking in at night, and I'm saying some scholars have interpreted this, because it doesn't tell us for sure, but some have interpreted this to mean that, okay, his intention is, I'm coming in there and I know there are people there, so I'm willing to do them harm. So murder could be intended along with theft. Whereas someone breaking in during the day, it could be assumed that the house is empty, they're out at work. Just like I've noticed, you know, I live in a neighborhood with sidewalks and curbs, and if for some reason I'm home during the week, during the day, I walk around and it's empty. You know, there's some people there, but not a lot. A lot of those houses I know no one's in. So a thief breaking in then probably is just meaning to steal, not do any harm. So this seems to imply, and notice I'm using the word seems and imply, there's a lot of equivocation there, but some people have interpreted this to mean that killing in self-defense was permissible in Israel's civil law, okay? And in certain circumstances only. You know, if the criminal could be apprehended or there's no apparent danger to the person, it's not considered killing in self-defense. And I'm couching this in equivocal terms, because there has been a strong debate in God's church and out of God's church for decades, for hundreds of years probably, over whether or not Christians can use force and or lethal force to protect themselves. And I've heard, you know, well-experienced ministers argue both sides of that argument. And so I try not to argue the argument. I'm willing to present that there is a debate for which you can make a case on both sides. The one thing I would say, you know, knowing that, the one side doesn't involve having any potential of guilt and having done wrong. If you don't kill someone, you don't have to worry about whether or not it was okay. But again, I'm not trying to make an argument one way or the other. I'm saying it's there, and this is one scripture that's been brought in to argue on that side of it. Oh yeah, okay, I've got some small writing I couldn't read that's saying, I don't want to get into that debate because it'll take all the rest of our time and we won't cover the rest of the material. But I find it intriguing. Again, this is still for a law for a political, social, civil group, you know, not for a church. And so how we would apply principles from then into our lives is not just a straightforward take it from here and plug it in there, because it's not necessarily the same. Is that making sense? I'm not trying to confuse the matter, but I don't want to skip something that could be controversial. Okay, then, let's move on. Verse 5, things seem to go quite a bit different. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, he'll make restitution from the best of his own vineyard. Okay, so allowing your animal to eat another man's crops is tantamount to you stealing those crops, so you have to make restitution. If a fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so stacked grain and standing grain or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall make restitution. We could say destroying another person's property is pretty much the same as stealing, so you have to make restitution. Now, I think it's built in that it could be done accidental, so it's not like you restore five times like you've stole the ox, but it's still, you have to make it up. Let's read verses 7 through 9. This is a little interesting. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it's stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he'll pay double. So, say, I'm going away, and I got a stash of money, and I don't have a bank because I'm in ancient Israel, so I give it to Andrew, say, keep my money safe. And someone breaks in his house and steals it. Okay, this is implying he's not guilty, but if we find the thief, then that thief has to pay double. Okay, but we go on then. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house will be brought to the judges to see whether he put his hand to his neighbor's good. So somebody breaks in and steals from Andrew's house, but it's my stuff. Then we go to court, and the judges will decide, is he lying? Did he really just steal it himself or not? And so basically you have a court trial, and you probably call in witnesses and gather evidence, and it can be like watching an episode of CSI or whatever. Yeah, verse 9 then, for any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox or a donkey, a sheep or a clothing, it's interesting. I'm talking about money there. They're talking about stuff, animals, clothing, things like that. Any kind of lost thing which another claims to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whoever the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. So, you know, when there's a doubt of who's guilty or what's the situation, okay, you come to the judges. And I would guess this is one of those cases. Remember, the judges meet at the gate of the city or the gate of the village. And it's just not just, you know, a door swinging open and closed. It's the formal place where it's like the county seat or the town center or whatever where government is held. So responsible official people, you know, make these decisions. And as I said, probably with witnesses and all that. Probably based on the idea that they know these people too. Brings to mind a principle that I was surprised when I studied this, and then I said, well, that makes perfect sense. Now, you've heard the term trial by a jury of your peers. What does a jury of your peers consist of? You know what a jury is?
Yeah.
Okay, a jury is a group of people going to make the decision. What are our peers? P-E-R-S. We've put it in modern terms to be people of a similar, you know, legal status and probably social status. But nowadays, if you have a trial, remember, they'll have a pre-trial hearing to choose a jury and say, do you know this guy? Well, you can't serve on the jury. Do you know anything about his past? Do you have prejudices? They won't allow those people to serve. In ancient times, it was the exact opposite. We wanted all the people that knew him. If I'm on trial, you want my neighbors and my aunt and uncle and everyone that's done business with me, because they know if I'm an honest guy or if I'm a jerk. And they'll take that into account making that decision. Am I trying to rip off Andrew by loaning him my stuff so I can, you know, break in and steal it and have him pay me back? And I say, ah, oh, we know Frank's a dirty double dealer. Andrew wouldn't do something like that. So it helps if you knew the guy. And so these judges were particular to each village. You didn't have to go to another town. You know, like nowadays, they'll remove a trial to have an unbiased jury. You say in old times, they wanted a biased jury. Not that they want them biased, but they want them informed. And I'm getting sidetracked here, but this is something that would apply when we talk about who these judges were. They might well be people that have known you all your life. And in some cases, I know Craig, he wouldn't do that. So, you know, unless there's very strong evidence otherwise, you know, that'll affect their decision. That makes sense? Okay, let's move a little further then. Were we in verse 10? Yeah. If a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any animal to keep, which seems funny in our society, here, keep my ox or my donkey. But, you know, whatever, you deliver some property, and it dies or is hurt or driven away, no one seeing it. Okay, so something happens to it, and we don't know what. Then an oath of the eternal shall be between them both, that he has not put his hand to his neighbor's goods. And the owner of it will accept it, and he won't make it good. Okay, so again, say I'm going out of town, and I ask Andrew to watch my dog for me. Take care of it, feed it. And he's away at work one day, and he comes home, and my dog is dead. And I come home and say, what happened to my dog? You know, he says, I swear, you know, I'll take an oath before God, I didn't kill your dog. And I believe him, the case is settled. You know, that seems to be what this is saying. But, verse 12, if in fact it's stolen from him, he'll make restitution to the owner of it. So if it turns out, Andrew agrees to watch my dog, which, by the way, it's not implied a person has to watch someone's animal, but he puts my dog out in the backyard and doesn't bother to close the gate, and my dog runs out and gets run over by a truck. Andrew, you got to make it good, you know, because you didn't close the gate. You're responsible. So it's implying this type of thing. And so it's stolen. In verse 13, but if it's torn to pieces by a beast, this is a very graphic description, he'll bring it as evidence and he'll not make good. So here the dog's in the backyard and a bald eagle swoops down and grabs it. Boy, I shouldn't have been using my dog as an example because I don't like where this is going. Let's say I've got an animal that I'm raising for meat, and I have no emotional attachment whatsoever, but it's still in Andrew's backyard, and a pack of wolves jump over the fence, and they kill it and eat it. Well, a pack of wolves could show up anywhere. Andrew's not responsible for that. He doesn't have to make it good. All this seems like it's getting very elaborate. Again, this seems to be based on situations that have really come up. And so God has probably worked through Moses to tell people, okay, this is how you deal with this kind of a situation. It's worth noting this is put in the Bible for generations and generations of future judges so that one day, you know, 300 years after this, there's a dispute in the town of Anathoth between Kayla and Michelle, and there's something about loaning her goat, and the goat got hurt, and they come to the judges and say, what do we do about this? The judges would use not only their common sense and their knowledge of the people, but they'd look at this law and say, oh yeah, this tells us this kind of principle applies here. So the judges for future years are going to look at this and it'll help them to make decisions even about cases that are not described. Because face it, we can come up with almost an infinite number of variables for things like this. But these overall principles of making restitution, of a punishment fitting a crime, of personal responsibility. That's another one I should have included. That comes out more later when God talks about sin, but the person who does the wrong is the one that has to pay. These overall principles guide God's law and the judgments that he gives. Oh yeah, let's get through verse 14. 14 and 15. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he'll surely make it good. If the owner was with it, he won't make it good. And if it was hired, it came for its hire. That's a little bit complex, but a lot of times this is referring to animals. We're more likely now to borrow tools. I've got a lawnmower that's damaged right now, and I've been meaning to make time to take it to the shop. I hit a root and stopped the engine dead. I don't know if it's either out of time or I might have bent a shaft. If I bent a shaft, I got to go get a new lawnmower. But imagine while my lawnmower is broke, I borrow Craig's lawnmower, okay, and I'm using it, and something bad happens to it. It's injured or it's died. I'm using his lawnmower and it becomes injured, or it breaks. Okay, you know, I'm responsible. I borrowed it, I was using it, and something bad, I'm responsible. But here it's saying that if the owner is with it, so Craig comes over to my house and he's showing this is how you use it, push it, and something happens, then it's implying he either knew something, you know, or that he could have stopped me from doing something, So he, since the owner is there, he has the responsibility. I don't have to pay to fix his lawnmower. And the last thing it says there is if it's hired, I don't say, Craig, will you please let me use your lawnmower? I say, Craig, I'll give you $40 if I can borrow your lawnmower for the next 3 weeks. And it says, okay, the $40 implies, you know, we made a contract, and whatever happens to it, you know, I don't have to pay for it if it goes bad. Does that make sense? And so this is just decisions that were made. There might be some circumstances where maybe, you know, the judges might determine that I did something to the lawnmower, even if I rented it, and I should pay to get it fixed. By the way, this isn't stuff that you have to memorize, but I hope we'll understand certain principles. You know, principles of doing what's right for each other, and like I said, you know, making restitution, not being over. You know, like if I borrow Craig's lawnmower and I break it, they're not going to cut off my left hand. You know, the punishment should fit the crime. I might just have to give him my lawnmower, which is too bad for him because my lawnmower is broke. That's why I borrowed his in the first place. Okay, you guys, you're with me on this. I'm trying not to go through this too fast because it can just seem like a jumble, and it sort of does anyways. Interesting case here in verses 16 and 17. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, that's a fancy way of saying he sweet talks a girl and they wind up in bed, but she wasn't engaged to someone, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. Okay, guys, you got to pay the cost, so to speak, and you got to get married, it's saying. So you sleep, you think about this, because you do this, you're committing to get married, and you got to pay the dowry. Remember, this is in ancient Israel. This is not the way, we don't enforce that in our nation or in the church. But it's interesting, in verse 17, if her father refuses to give her to him, okay, I'm not letting my daughter marry that guy. I don't care if she did sleep with him. No way. The young man, assuming it's a young man, still has to pay the dowry. That's what it says. If the father refuses, he shall pay the money according to the price of virgins. Okay, so, you know, two options can happen. But two young people get together, they decide they're going to sleep together. God's saying, okay, you made a commitment, you got to get married. But the father has a veto power over that. And why does the young man still have to pay then? It doesn't tell us, but I think there is a reason, or at least a potential reason. One is there's a punishment. The girl, she's suffering in other ways probably. A girl in that situation, the father won't let her marry him. There's a fair chance she's not going to marry anyone else either, or that other men won't want to. She's not a virgin anymore. In that society, there was a high price on that. And so him paying that money to the family would help support her because they might be supporting her for the rest of her life. At least there's an implication that that might be the reason. Do you guys follow that? So, and again, I'm stressing, you know, because we, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, but if I did a broad survey in the Church of God, we'd find a number of people who fell into this as a mistake. And it's not meant, okay, sorry, you got to get married. You know, it's better to be repentant rather than ruin your life by marrying someone that's not the right person. Because God does allow for repentance. We're not in ancient Israel living under that political law. So, and by the way, that doesn't mean go out and do it because there's no consequences. That's just the emotional, spiritual consequences are much greater. So let's move on. Next one's a lot simpler. Verse 18, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Some versions say a witch. So witchcraft brings capital punishment. God didn't mess around on that. And witchcraft generally included trying to make contact with evil spirits. The medium or witch at Endor that King Saul went to had what they called a familiar spirit. God says, no, we don't mess with that. Verse 19, whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. This doesn't mean letting your dog sleep at the foot of your bed. My dog doesn't sleep on my bed because she can't jump up that high, but she sleeps on Connor's bed. This is referring to bestiality, and that was punishable by death. Matter of fact, I think it says, I'm not sure if it says it here or somewhere else, the animal also, yeah, elsewhere it says the animal was put to death. Verse 20, he who sacrifices to any god except the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Okay, that it's interesting because it doesn't say death. Utterly destroyed is, you guys have come across that term before, right? Harem, I've seen it spelled this way, well, with a C-H, or harem, or harem, which means utterly destroyed, which is the way it's interpreted there. It can also mean separated or devoted to God. Because I find it curious, you came across that in the book of Joshua and Judges, where, okay, those pagan people, they're subject to harem, utter destruction. But there are places where parts of the sacrifice are described as harem, because they're totally devoted to God and not to be shared. And of course, a lot of those sacrifices will be totally burnt up, and they're destroyed in that way. So it's a word that's used in more than one way, but it involves complete devotion to whatever the fate is. Yeah, so we've got witchcraft, bestiality, and idolatry all seem to be capital offenses. It's worth us noting that elsewhere in the Bible, we see that that's talking about this physical life now. We know that there's going to be a resurrection and a chance for repentance and a chance to be in God's family. So there will be plenty of witches, plenty of people who've committed bestiality or worshipped idols who will be resurrected and having a chance for repentance. And when God chooses to remember a sin no more, He chooses to remember that no more. Remember, we read in Isaiah where God says, "I will not remember your sins." That applies to all these sins. Everything we've covered so far falls under that. And every sin that all of us have committed falls under that. So, you know, death penalty in this life is not the end, which is good for all of us, right? Let's go to verse 21. "You shall neither mistreat a stranger or oppress him. You are strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way, they cry out to me, I'll surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot. And I'll kill you with the sword, and your wives will be widows and your children fatherless." That's interesting, because the things God says here to do, He doesn't say the judges will inflict a punishment. He's saying, I'll do this. I just find that intriguing. You know, if you're afflicting other people, if you're afflicting a widow or fatherless, God will take care of that Himself. And He's saying, I'll make you, your children fatherless, and your wife a widow. So there, that sense of irony comes up. And I think it's interesting that God, we'll read later, that God will set up what we call the third tithe system, and also gleaning as a way to care for those people. So not oppressing the fatherless and the widow partly comes from taking the tithe of every third year and setting aside for them to eat, or not going back over your fields and gleaning them, but allowing people like Ruth to come and get it. Moving on in verse 25. Yes?
Question about 20, where you said utterly destroyed. Were you saying that they are killed?
It seems to be implied. I was noting there's a different word, but I'm not sure how you could utterly destroy someone without killing them. So, but it is curious, there's a different word, and it seems to be related to what God would say that the foreign peoples in the land were. It's sort of like you're going to treat them as though they're not even part of Israel. Perhaps that's the implication. Which verses 25 through 27 deal with interest. "If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, don't be like a money lender to them. You shall not charge interest. If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, return it to him before the sun goes down. That's his only covering. It's his garment for his skin. What'll he sleep in? It'll be when he cries out that I'll hear, for I am gracious." So it's basically talking about taking collateral. So it's, well, I think Kayla's always freezing. It's like, okay, I'll make you a loan, but give me that red coat, you know. And God's saying, no, she gets cold. Don't take that. Give it to her. And if you do, give it to her before it gets dark, because then it's really going to get cold. This thing about interest, though, I want to make the point, because it's gone back and forth. Is interest itself a sin? Because I've got money in the bank and I'm getting paid interest, and I'm happy, except I'm not getting paid very much because the price of money is so low. I think it means a little bit different than that. Interest here, the Hebrew is neshek, N-E-S-H-E-C-H, which means interest, but it's derived from a different Hebrew word, neshek, which is N-A-S-H-A-C-H, and that word means to bite. And so what we've seen, scholars think, is where it says, "You shall not charge interest," It could be described as not, you shall not charge biting interest or devouring interest. Meaning it's not that you can't charge any interest on a loan or get any interest paid, but taking advantage of somebody by charging more than the loan is worth. You could say, don't be a loan shark. Don't be like these payday lenders where they're going to charge you 400% interest or something ridiculous. I don't know, I saw that on TV the other day and I thought, do they really charge that? So it's not necessarily, you know, no interest. Although the point is, as far as among friends or family, I want to stop picking on the front row. If Matt comes to me and says, oh, I'm short of money for lunch, can you loan me $5? I should say, yeah, I got $5. Get it back to me when you can. I shouldn't say, okay, I'll give you $5 today if you give me back $7 tomorrow. It's like God saying, don't be that way. Come on, you know, be like family and brothers. But if Matt says, I'm starting a business, would you invest money in my business and we'll draw up a contract and you'll get this percentage of the profits? That's a totally different thing. And I think it's generally understood in all of Christianity, you know, whether people call themselves Christian but don't believe all that we do or otherwise, that there is that distinction. You guys follow what I'm getting at? So no biting in usury or interest, but you know, business is business. Business is okay if it's still not cheating business. And of course, I would mention the example that Jesus Christ used with the parables of the pounds and the parable of the talents. He demonstrates that interest in itself isn't a sin. Verse 28, you shall not revile God nor curse a ruler of your people. The word there for God is Elohim, a word that we commonly use, and it often means God, the God. But it is worth noting that Elohim, of and by itself, can also mean a ruler or an official of the people. And there's discussion back and forth that that could mean, in some places, some translations of the Bible say, you shall not revile a magistrate or a judge of your people. And the Hebrew could allow for that. And that would fit what Paul cites this in Acts 23, verse 5. In Acts 23:5, where he says, oh, you know, the law says you shouldn't speak evil of the ruler of your people. And he's talking about a high priest, even though that high priest was doing wrong. So we still shouldn't speak evil of God, but that almost seems like, you know, God doesn't have to tell us that. And of course, there he says, revile God or the ruler of your people. So we make sure we're including it either way. Verse 29, do not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you'll give to me, and likewise with your oxen and your sheep. It'll be with its mother 7 days, but on the eighth you'll give it to me. This is reiterating what God had said back in chapter 13. Exodus 13, verse 11, where he said, all the firstborn is mine. What's different here is he adds plants and produce. So he's saying the first of your crops, and here he says juices, meaning, you know, like if you get grapes or whatever and you squeeze them, orange juices, I guess. Now, back in Exodus 13, he provided the means to redeem. So, like, I've got a fine thoroughbred that's the firstborn of this horse. I can keep it and redeem it with another animal. So, and of course, if my son is born, like I have a firstborn son, you know, I don't have to sacrifice him because God's pretty strongly opposed to that. But in ancient Israel, I would redeem him. And I'll remind you again, this is the civil law for ancient Israel tied in with the sacrificial system. I don't know of any way that particularly applies to us in this era. You know, one of the things we say is in our era, we do tithe to God. The first, you know, the first 10% of our increase, our income, goes to God. And that seems to be the principle of this carried on. I'm not to the end yet. I will just mention verse 31, it says, you shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat meat torn by beasts in the field. Throw it to the dogs. Okay, this one of the aspects of being holy is mentioned here, and many more will be added. One of the reasons this seems to be saying, okay, you find a dead animal in the field, you can't eat it. Probably largely because it's likely not to have been bled out properly. And so the blood would stay in it and probably coagulate. So if you ate it, you'd be eating blood. And we remember from back in Genesis 9 that God strongly forbade that. and it's repeated again throughout the ritual law. So God is very strongly opposed to eating blood. So he's like, you find an animal that died on its own or was killed by another animal, don't eat it. Well, that's a good stopping point. We're going to start with chapter 23 next time.